Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, a counterpart show to the Who We Are Now conversation I had with activists and advocates after the election. Here's a bit of what that sounded like.
What would help me the most from those who really stand behind Trump, or even those who kind of held their nose and voted for him, would be a willingness to say, you know, we do want change. But at the same time, I'm willing to stand up to my party and fight for human decency. And you can see threads of it in staunch Republicans like John McCain, who stood up to his party and said, torture's not okay. Instead of telling me, be quiet now, you lost.
But can I push back against that binary? Because I think that Democrats can be equally as structurally racist, too. I don't think it's just Trump. Racial ideologies or this racial ignorance exist on all sides.
This hour, the Republican view of who we are after such a divisive and tumultuous election and what it means for the party and what it means for not just the Republicans, but also Democrats as well. And I'm interested in what you think as you listen into the conversation. Now that the dust has settled a bit, how do you think we've emerged from the election? Do we understand one another better? Have you had some insight that you can share? Do that on social media during the roundtable. You can tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest for the roundtable, Carrie Rood, is a Republican state senator in Minnesota's legislature, where she is assistant minority leader. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Annette Meeks is the founder and CEO of the Freedom Foundation of Minnesota. Welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thrilled to be here. Thank you.
And Marty Seifert is a former state legislator and currently a lobbyist for Flaherty and Hood. Really good to have you on the roundtable.
Hello.
Welcome. Good to have you here. Annette, you were with me on a roundtable months ago, before the convention, now that I think about it. And I'm curious about whether you've had some thoughtful conversations with fellow Republicans after the results of this election.
Oh, my goodness. Lots of them. I spent last week out in Washington, and it's really interesting to see this is really a populist turn for what was previously a very orthodox conservative party. And to see the populist element bubble up and what that means in public policy, I think is very exciting, especially for those of us here in Minnesota where there's a very strong populist streak. I think that's one of the reasons why Trump did so well here. And I think there's many opportunities for us, both in the state legislature and in Washington, to capitalize on some of that and the opportunities it will bring to Minnesota.
We'll come back to the populism piece of this. I want to play something that you said during that roundtable before the convention and see if you still feel that way. Let's listen.
He's hijacked the Republican Party. He doesn't stand for what we stand for. He doesn't uphold the ideals of what our party platform stands for. I look at someone like Donald Trump and say, he does not represent me.
So has your view changed of the president-elect?
Well, in many ways, it has and hasn't. He is not a conservative. I still believe that. I think Donald Trump would probably tell you that. He is a populist who has a very strange mandate that he has put together by piecing together conservative elements, populist elements, and a strong independent streak. You saw that most recently Tuesday morning when he canceled the contract that was for two new Air Force One jet. That was an enormous budget liability that, frankly, our government doesn't have. That's a populist move that appeals to fiscal conservatives. So I look at someone like Donald Trump and think, that's how you're going to govern? That's terrific.
Okay, Carrie, you were a Trump supporter, right? Or are a Trump supporter?
Oh, 100%.
Okay, so is he first to what Annette said, and then we'll talk about some of the things that he's already doing. What do you think about her kind of diagnosis of where Trump is and where the party is?
Well, I see such a great excitement in the party. I think we have become so much more inclusive than we ever were before. We're growing the party. We have people that are excited that never were excited before. And I just see that he is going to, you know, we're looking at not so much the Republican Party, but America and where we are going. And I think that's what we're excited about. We've kind of put the party politics aside a little bit because we're looking at America, and that's what people are excited about.
You know, the party leaders kind of put the party politics aside very reluctantly, right? You know that a lot of them were not supportive of him for some of the reasons that you've just said. Is that okay? Do they have to get on the train or get out?
Well, I think that's the whole message is we're tired of politics as usual. We're tired of the the party politics in Washington. We want that change. We want that breath of fresh air. We want the change. That's why people voted for Trump, because we're really tired of the good old boy politics that we have been saddled with for years.
Marty, Trump supporter or not?
No, I came aboard Trump. I started as a Scott Walker guy and migrated to Marco Rubio and then migrated to Trump. So I was a delegate at the National Convention this last year, which was kind of wild compared to when I was a delegate in 08. But I do think that Trump brought out, as the previous two speakers said, the populism. Now when it comes to governing, I had one person that was a big Trump person. They're like, well, you know, we always felt like we were on the outside of the Republican establishment castle with our torches and pitchforks, and we finally scaled the drawbridge and got inside, and now we're not sure what to do. You know, we really want to know how to govern now that Trump is the president. But you look at some of these picks that he has for his cabinet and some of the names being thrown around, they will govern. They have to govern. I think people are underestimating Donald Trump. He's been successful in life, in business, and a lot of things. And so the expectations are probably a little more modest in terms of him coming to office. And, of course, we had the drumbeat all summer and fall that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And I think the shock of the people who are naysayers is really, it's hard for that to sink in, that he actually won this thing. It reminds me of the Jesse Ventura victory when I was in the legislature.
Yeah, I'm going to get to that. I want to ask you about that. Carrie used the word inclusive, and she said, we're bringing more people into the Republican Party than we've seen before. You know, you all know that the critique is that you might have more voters that look like the party, but who have not voted before, not been involved politically, but it doesn't look like a very diverse, it does not look like a very diverse representation of what America is today. Is that changing?
I think there's some fair critique in that, although at the election night party that was held in the Twin Cities on election night, I was told by people, I was not there, I was doing radio commentary back home, but that there were a lot of people who showed up, women, minorities, etc., that they had never seen at a Republican event before. And it was interesting, like going to the national convention and meeting people that, like Senator Ruud, what I call the classy women who are just want to change in government, who are not, people that were uninvolved in politics. Obviously, a lot of these folks voted, but they really wanted to see change in their government, and they grabbed the bull by the horns.
What do you think, Annette?
I think Trump has huge expectations by especially many of the new voters, that people do expect change in Washington, and they expect him to get things done, things that most people are so frustrated with. Let's start with Obamacare. If that is not repealed within the first 100 days and the Congress then starts to work on what will replace it, keeping some of the popular things like coverage for pre-existing conditions and other things, if that's not done in the first 100 days, I think people will be very frustrated once again. I think some of the other promises he's made, such as major tax overhaul, looking at some of the other economic justice issues that were debated throughout the campaign, meaning jobs. We need jobs, and not minimum wage jobs. We need jobs that support families, and we need them in greater Minnesota and throughout the state, not just in the Twin Cities metro area. Everybody can't live in the 7-county metro area. And those are the promises he made that he needs to keep, and I would guess he has about a 200-day honeymoon. I agree with Marty that this guy has appointed what is like a conservative all-star cabinet thus far, and I look at these people and think these are very, very competent people who can get stuff done, especially Congressman Price on the overhaul of Obamacare. But expectations are very high.
The question at the center of this is who we are. You would say who we are is skeptical and expectant. Is he going to be able to deliver a lot of what he promised?
I think there's a lot of people who have placed very high hopes, as Senator Rudd was saying, one of the expectations are that things will change. It's not going to be business as usual of a candidate who gets out there and makes grand promises, then goes to Washington and forgets all about that. I think this is quite the opposite, where people expect him to have a bold agenda in those first 200 days and to get it done. And if he can't get it done, I think he has a unique microphone for a very limited time to go out and blast people who are the impediments to getting the job done.
Carrie, you know what's interesting about that is it wasn't all that different for President-elect Obama. There were a lot of people that projected a lot of expectations and hopes on him. And what happened when he got to Washington was he found that it was going to be very difficult to enact a lot of his agenda. Now, and he had Democrats in control for the first couple of years of his administration. What do you think about what Annette says about this expectation that Trump has to deliver?
Well, I think when Obama was elected, we never thought that anything would be different. It would be just the same verse.
We didn't? We didn't think it was going to be different with the first African-American president?
No. I think
really?
No. I think he went to Washington and did the same thing that everybody always does. I never expected anything different from him. I really didn't. But I do expect it from Trump, and I see that he's not even president yet, and look at his cabinet that he's putting together. It's amazing, and he's very deliberative. He is talking to people that, you know, a lot of times when people, they have the opponent, they never talk to them again. They're like, and he's taking them all in. He's talking to them. He's talking to Romney. He's talking to all these people who were not for him. He's creating an agenda that's inclusive of everyone. They're going to have their voice, but yet he's being very deliberative, and I think his picks are phenomenal.
One of the conversation points leading up to the election was the tenor of the campaign, the sometimes rude and adversarial ways that Donald Trump behaved, just the way that the campaign debate sounded. Marty, is who we are after the election more accepting of that if you can deliver on the things we've waited so long to see done? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, as a Minnesotan, it's somewhat unique because if this is about who we are as Minnesotans and Americans in general,
yeah.
I mean, I certainly, coming, you know, born and raised in Minnesota, I don't like mainstreaming impoliteness.
Do you think that happened?
Regardless of party. Well, I mean, there's obviously Donald Trump has said things that I wouldn't agree with. But, you know, honestly, there's with all of us, there's personality and there's policy. And I think a lot of his policies I'm on board with. The style, I mean, I think Twitter needs to be backed off a little bit on some of the things, the 3 a.m. tweets. Those are just things I think the average person would agree with. But in Minnesota, the way we are, I mean, you go back to when we voted at caucuses and he came in last place. I think a lot of that was style in one part. But if you take a look at how he was able to stitch together, we have kind of the populist alt-right group. We have kind of the religious conservatives. We kind of have the establishment business conservatives. And then you've got that those three pillars all have to come together. Trump, for better or for worse, stitched together that coalition because he almost carried Minnesota. And I would argue if McMullen wasn't on the ballot, he would have carried Minnesota. There's not a lot of people in the last few years that could do that. Tim Pawlenty stitched together just a very narrow plurality in 2006. That's about the last time anyone's come close to it. So I have to give some credit. Do I have concerns about, you know, mainstreaming and politeness? Absolutely. But I'm hoping as he takes office that, you know, that changes. But as I alluded to earlier, other people would say Jesse Ventura, mainstreaming
right,
and politeness, and he was governor of our state.
That's right.
So there are a lot of us, and I live in the rural area, that kind of want to tell it like it is. We're tired of political correctness garbage. And I think that kind of is what some of this populist fuel came from.
Carrie, what would you say about that? Who we are as somebody who tolerates a different tone in the political rhetoric?
Well, I won my race by 65%. Mm-hmm. I do not live in a 65% district. I'm probably Republican plus two, maybe three. And so for me to win my election by 65%, I know that it was the Trump effect that brought this whole train in, as we say. And so he did build this coalition of people who wanted him in. But I think part of the problem is when I listen to his speeches and I listen to what he says, it's not necessarily what the media reports. And right now, you know, he said that if a business left, then when they brought their product back in, there would be a tariff on mm-hmm. it. Well, the media is now reporting, well, if you do business overseas, you're going to be taxed. That's not it's not anything what he said. And so now we're building this whole story on something that an interpretation of really what he didn't say.
But I found that
over and over and over again, that the media, you watch the Sunday talk shows, you watch all of them, and they kind of like to report how they want that to be, not necessarily what he says.
But let me ask you this. You know, a lot of the rhetoric came right from him during the primary debates, right? The way he interacted with the other Republican candidates. Some of it comes right out of his Twitter feed. I mean, I think we had a sense of how blunt and sometimes unpleasant and downright rude he was willing to be in that campaign conversation. I'm asking you if maybe as voters, we don't care that much about that anymore.
Well, don't you see in the primary, so he beat 17 other people.
Right.
There were 17 people. And so his rhetoric in the primary was pretty abrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And he won. And then I've seen this candidate change as he won and he campaigned. And now you see the president-elect. And I have seen him change from that person that was running in the primary that had to beat 17 other people to the person that only had to beat one other person. And now we have the president-elect, who is a totally different person than that person in the primary. And so you've seen him evolve and become, I think, very presidential. So I think he was who he had to be to win.
Annette, what would you say?
Well, I've been reading a lot. I've been on a lot of flights lately and trying to understand this phenomena as it has occurred. Somebody's going to write a great book about this election.
Yeah.
I can't wait to read it. But what I think is so interesting about what the senator just said is there's been a thread that has been very common throughout all of our elections since 2008 when President Obama first took office. And what it has been is economic justice, that there has been a feeling amongst many, many Americans and a lot of Minnesotans that things aren't fair in America anymore. The American dream applies to the 1%, not to the rest of us, that there are jobs and opportunities if you live in certain areas, not for the rest of us. And if you commit certain crimes, and I'm not referring to Senator Clinton, but if you commit crimes or if you're a big bank, the rules don't apply to you. They do to us if we run a small bank. They do to us who have to pay the Obamacare premiums if we're independent small businessmen. And I think that sense of justice allowed people to look the other way when Donald Trump said things that people found so personally offensive and say, you know what? He does say this about that. And that issue
and that matters more to me as a voter than
being politically correct.
Yeah.
I think it's genuine. That's if you look at what people have in common, successful politicians who come out of nowhere and do well, especially Minnesota, but other places too. Paul Wellstone, Jesse Ventura, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, don't forget about him. Is regardless if you agree or disagree on this or that or the manner in which they say things, they have that genuine streak that they can look you in the eye and say, you know what, you may not like the way I'm saying this, but this is the way it is. And I always had people that I would say, you're voting for Paul Wellstone, who's way to the left, or you're voting for Ventura, who's impolite or this or that. And people would say, you know what, at least I know they're honest and they're telling it like it is.
And people believe things have gotten way on the wrong track and that this is the guy who's going to be the disruptor. He's going to go to Washington, shake things up and get things done. That's the economic justice that I hear about all over the place. And I've been reading some really good articles, especially about the too big to fail. There's a lot of people who think, let them fail. Yeah, nobody cares right. about mainstream businesses. Nobody cares about small town America. And they are failing.
And it was
and
all about rushing to the rescue of the banks, you're
yes,
saying.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And people are fed up with that.
Here's what both of you having served in the state legislature, is the idea and the commitment to disrupt easier than actually fulfilling it?
It is. It's easier to be in the minority and be a rouser of rabble than it is to govern and get a budget target and you're a committee chair and you're told, get this train to run on time because we don't want to have government shutting down. And so it is easier to be a disruptor, especially when you're campaigning, but then also when you're in the minority in the legislature. And you know, Senator Root has a big task. You've got a 34-33 margin. One vote. and one person can suddenly change right. the agenda when they just go to caucus and say, you know what, I can't do this. I can't live with this. And with the populist streak that Annette was talking about, I mean, the Republicans have to be cautious about, even in Minnesota, we're going to buy down the minsure rates for people on the individual market. Are you going to give people a check or are the insurance companies getting a check? And then we all hope that eventually that money is going to show up in the hands of the people paying the premiums. And I'm already hearing people back home saying, you know, I heard rumor that, you know, we're really not going to get the money. The farmers who are seeing $2.80 corn, those are the people on the individual marketplace getting killed with these insurance premium increases. How do the details work? And so I think Republicans will have some governing to do, and being a disruptor in the campaign mm-hmm. will really translate into, can you be a person to govern now after the election?
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. I want to remind you who's on the roundtable with us today and what we're considering. We're asking, it's kind of a counterpart conversation to the one we had right after the election where we talked more to activists and advocates. Today, the view from the Republican side of this about who we are in the wake of the election, what the election of President-elect Trump says about the party, our communities, us in a wider sense as Americans. Senator Carrie Root is with us. She's a Republican state senator in Minnesota state legislature, assistant minority leader. Marty Seifert is with us. He's a former state legislator and currently a lobbyist for Flaherty and Hood. And Annette Meeks is with us, founder and CEO of the Freedom Foundation of Minnesota. I should have said, you're okay with me calling you Carrie, not Senator.
Absolutely.
First names usually on the roundtable. But you started to say something and I interrupted you with that. What were you going to add to that?
You know, we talk about this is the first time that the Republicans have had a four-year majority in 44 years. And so it's a really different feeling. I've been in the minority my whole career. And usually after an election, you go to the Capitol and you elect your minority leader, and then you wait for the majority to call you and tell you what you're going to do in January and what committee you're going to sit on. And so all of a sudden I get the call and I'm on the committee of committees, and we have to decide what committees we're going to have and who are the chairs and what is the makeup and what do you hope to accomplish. And then you have your majority leadership, and you have it's a totally different idea, and it's for me to get my arms around this. It's really amazing because I know I have to govern now. I have an opportunity to set the pace, to help decide where we're going, and it's really a responsibility that I take immense pleasure in having the opportunity to do. But I realize. Really what that responsibility entails.
Can I ask you this? When you said set the pace and the obligation and the responsibility of this, how do you think about the responsibility of also representing those voters who desperately wanted Bernie Sanders and desperately wanted Hillary Clinton or who support what Governor Dayton wants? I mean, how do you think about them?
Well, I always think about them, and I always, when I run my election, I always make sure that people know when I'm elected. I represent everyone, not just the people that voted for me.
But you say that, but tell me how you put that into action.
Well, I listen to all the voices, and I might think that going in this direction is the right way to go. But I have to listen to all the voices and all the conversation. And so I go into my district and I really listen to what people have to say. And sometimes they form the direction we're going. I always look, you know, I am a conservative at heart, but I always have to listen to the whole voice that we hear.
And when you listen, you learn. What are the interests that serve more people, serve the majority of the people, rather than a narrow minority that maybe elected a few of those members? And that's part of the agenda setting that becomes so important from this point forward. We're here to govern. We're here to represent all people. And it's the same thing when people used to say, President Obama is not my president. Yeah, he is. I got news for you. He is. And he deserves the respect of that office. And he has the obligation to set an agenda for all people. And I think that's one of the areas where President Obama really failed, is it was a very narrow agenda appealing to a very special class of individuals. And I think that's where Senator Clinton lost. She followed that narrow agenda instead of looking for a broader, more broad appeal agenda that will lift all people. That the Democrats nationally have gotten away from that. And the Republicans under Donald Trump, he picked up that mantle and ran with it and ran successfully.
I'm really glad you brought that up. We'll take a news break here and I'll come back to this idea of not my president. You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. Our question kind of at the center of the conversation is who we are after this most recent divisive election. But it's not news to you that we have been a polarized electorate for a number of years, and we're contemplating what that means here as we go into a new administration. Senator Carrie Rood with us, Annette Meeks with us, and Marty Seifert with us. We'll get a look at the latest news, and we'll continue our conversation.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom. Two Michigan Supreme Court members have removed themselves from consideration of an appeal by Green Party presidential nominee Jill Stein, who is pushing for a presidential recount to resume in Michigan. The two justices made Donald Trump's list of possible U.S. Supreme Court nominees. The move comes 2 days after a federal judge ended the recount, saying Stein had no legal standing to request the recount. The Great Smoky Mountains National Park and the resort town of Gatlinburg, Tennessee, have reopened to the public after wildfires that caused 14 deaths and damaged about 2,500 buildings. Officials today removed barriers blocking a roadway into town. Authorities say an interstate east of Cleveland is open again after a pileup of about 50 vehicles in snowy conditions. The Lake County Sheriff's Office says about 20 people were injured in yesterday's chain reaction crash. A 40-car pileup earlier in Michigan included 3 fatalities. A World Anti-Doping Agency investigation says Russian athletes backed by the government corrupted the 2012 London Olympics on an unprecedented scale. No Russian athlete tested positive for a prohibited substance at the London Games, as the country collected 24 gold medals, 26 silvers, and 32 bronze medals. And the residents of John Glenn's hometown in eastern Ohio say he never forgot where he came from and always made time to talk with anyone who wanted to visit. Flags around New Concord have been lowered, and the university where he was a trustee held a moment of silence before a basketball game yesterday after the former astronaut and U.S. senator died earlier in the day. Glenn became a national hero in 1962 when he became the first American to orbit the Earth. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:34.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
Programming is supported by Health Partners and MakeItOkay.org, a campaign to start conversations about mental illness and stop the stigma. You can learn more about the misconceptions around mental illness at MakeItOkay.org.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable, and it's a conversation among three people with a lot of political experience and some really insightful observations here into the idea of who we are after this most recent polarized election, but who we are in the wake of a number of divisive elections. Senator Carrie Rood with us, Marty Seifert with us, and Annette Meeks is with us on the roundtable. And Annette, before we went to the news break there, you brought up this idea of rejecting the legitimacy, I guess is what I ought to say, of the president. And that is happening now with Donald Trump, and it happened to President Obama. I'd like to know what you think about that and what you think it says.
I think it is so unhelpful that whether you like the president personally or not, he is the president. He was duly elected, and he's the president of all people. And we owe it to our country to put those bigger interests first rather than narrow partisan interests. Look, I agreed with probably nothing President Obama did or has done during the last 7.5 years. But he is still the president of the United States, and I don't discount that he was elected. What I think his mistake was not putting forward a big agenda that would help lift all people, the old John F. Kennedy, a rising tide lifts all boats. And instead, it was a very narrow, very specific agenda that appealed only to a very small people on the far left. It's the same comment that I heard from my congressman, Keith Ellison, who said, my job is easy. I just vote no. That's a very harmful thing to say, not only for our democracy, but also as we move forward with an agenda to help all people. Really, Keith, that's the best you can do? Vote no? Come on. What happened to the loyal opposition? What happened to the ability to work together for the common good? And I think that's where Donald Trump has a unique ability. He cuts through all that that chatter of the chattering class.
You are sure sounding like you like him better now.
I'll tell you, everything he's done since the election has just, it's been remarkable. And like I said earlier in the week, when he cut the plans for Air Force One, I look at stuff like this and think, yeah, we could get behind this guy pretty easily. Getting rid of Obamacare, I'm with you. Where do you want to start? But I think that's also the unique job that our legislative leaders have, that we have 4 years of control in the state Senate. It's their obligation to put forward bills and legislation that ultimately, when enacted, will help all Minnesotans, not appeal to a small group.
Marty, hashtag not my president. During the Obama administration and now potentially during the Trump administration?
I'm with Annette on that. Same way, I don't agree with what Obama's been doing, and he's still our president. I would be offended if people were running around with signs, regardless of the governor or whoever it is. They were elected. You go with who is governing. And really, the legislature, you take a look at like last session, the tax bill, when it came back, passed unanimously. Democrats and Republicans voted for the tax bill 67-0. There were, obviously both sides had to give something. Now, we had a Republican House and a Democrat Senate. But the two sides that maybe had some extreme elements had their stuff dropped. And I think as they move possibly to a special session here soon, you'll see that bill come back. And it's really hard for someone who 5 months ago voted for it to now say, I don't like it for some reason. The surplus is there. But that might be an example for how things should work in Washington, is that people like Senator Rood listened to their constituents. They had small business tax cuts. They had other things in that bill. And, hopefully, and obviously Governor Dayton is still there. So on the state level, the federal level, they're still going to have to work together, because on the Senate level, you have the filibuster. So unless they use the budget reconciliation process, they're going to have to at least move a little bit more towards mainstream on some things, or it won't pass over in the Senate. But for, Supreme Court appointments and some of these other things, I've been pretty impressed with the names that have been brought up and some of the agenda that's been put forward.
Carrie, hashtag not my president. Did you feel dismayed about that during President Obama's administration? What does that say to you? Yeah.
Well, I agree with Annette. I was not an Obama fan, but he was my president, and that office deserves respect. And once you have your president in office, you can disagree with them, but that office garners respect. I feel the same way about our governor. I believe I have a good working relationship with him. When he comes to my district, I think that office deserves recognition. It deserves respect. So when he visits my district, I greet him. I welcome him into my district. We disagree on a lot of very basic things. But he is the governor, and in the end, I'm going to chair the Environment and Natural Resources. It's a big committee. Mm-hmm. I know that he has a lot of things that he would like to accomplish, and in order for me to get my job done for the citizens in the state of Minnesota, I will have to work with the governor. And so you need to have respect for that office. It holds power. They were duly elected, And I think that we can do that. But like Annette said, you have to have respect for that office that they were duly elected, and you go from there. And then you can have your disagreements, but you learn how to work within that framework.
I want to ask you something. You've all just a thought has occurred to me because you've all said that you've spent the last 7.5 years disagreeing with most of what President Obama did, but you've also recognized the responsibility and the legitimacy of the office. Marty, if you could say one thing about President Obama's tenure that is something positive, what would it be that kind of says, I know he was working for the common good, even though I didn't agree with a lot of what he did? What would it be?
You know, if you do comparisons, I really think he's been a good example as a family person, a father to his daughters, a husband to his wife, which is much in contradiction to the previous Democratic president, frankly. I think he's been a good example just as who you want as a person, policy-wise.
Character-wise, this is what you're saying?
I think he does have – I don't think that Barack Obama is a dishonest person. I think he went above and beyond purview on executive orders and some of those things. But in terms of being a father to his daughters, a husband to his wife, I think he set a good example, and he should be – told, you know what, good job with that.
Annette, you didn't agree with most of what he did. You just said that. How would you answer that question?
I would agree with Marty that I think he's.
No,
said
you
it.
Don't get to say the same
I
thing.
I don't get to say the same thing. That's exactly what popped
else.
Into my mind.
Because I see Carrie over there going, yeah, that's what I'll. I
look at him and believe that in his heart of hearts, he has tried to do much that has not been particularly helpful for some of the poorest of the poor in our country. And I think in his heart of hearts, he has tried to govern as someone who will help those in the lowest echelons of our economy. I think he's been misguided in some of those policies, and they haven't had the effects that he wants. But I do think in his heart of hearts, he was legitimately trying to do something for the poverty and the education achievement gaps and different things like that that are just persistent problems in our culture today. And I think he's tried. I don't think he's been successful, but I do think he's tried.
Carrie, what would you say?
Oh, gosh, I'm just struggling here. You know, I'm really big on tourism in Minnesota, so I think he's been great for golf courses.
Yeah.
And I think he's been great for vacations and where to go and how to have fun.
Are you being serious?
No, that's the only thing I could come up with.
You're
really?
Struggling. You're struggling with something. Well, he did say in fairness, he did what he said he would do. He said he had end the war in Iraq. Whether people agree or disagree with that, he did some of it. He said he would grow government, you know, politely in a different way, but... you know, spent a lot of money. I think that stimulus passed probably the first 100 days, that $1 trillion stimulus. I disagreed with spending that much money that we didn't have, but he did what he said he would do. Now, I don't disagree with what he did, but at least you give him some credit for follow-up, I guess.
Does he get credit for that in your... No.
Well, for... I'm reaching
for straws. Yeah. You're trying to think of some good stuff.
Good. I like to make you all think. That's part of the Friday Roundtable, which, if you've just tuned in, is what you're listening to. It's a Friday Roundtable with a roundtable in a studio of Republicans. Some were Donald Trump supporters, others not. And we're talking about who we are as we emerge from this election and we look ahead to the next administration. Marty Seifert with us, Annette Meeks, and Carrie Rood. Here's another question that I want to ask you all about. The media is going through a who are we now exercise. How do you think the news media should react when the person who is going to be president tweets the kinds of things that Donald Trump tweets? You know, he'll say something like, hey, there's massive voter fraud, and that's the reason that I didn't win the popular vote, and Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. Marty, I'll come to you on that.
You know, I look at it, and I hate to make the comparisons of Ventura all the time because I was in the legislature.
Oh, I thought often, having covered just Ventura.
You were an NPR at number 11 at the time. But
no,
you,
I was at CARE 11.
You followed the jackal tags.
Oh, yeah.
And the kind of the public demonization of the press.
Oh,
was
I still
kind
have
of,
a jackal T-shirt.
Yeah,
Marty.
I mean, it was mainstream in 1999. And really the media kind of, you know, I think they were emboldened by it, and they followed him even more closely.
Yeah.
And it really, you had this kind of, you know, the media almost like crystallized together. Like they enjoyed being demonized.
We did.
I'm not sure with the president-elect right now. I think he's changing things in Washington. Like, I don't have to tell you when I go to dinner with my kids, where the press corps expects them to be told every minute, this is what I'm going to do, or I'm interviewing this cabinet secretary. Now, the legitimate public doings of government, obviously, is a right for the American people to know what's going on. We don't like secretiveness and so forth. But he also has to have a personal life. And I think it's going to be a very interesting 4 years. I mean, it's one thing with Ventura is 4 years of just, you never knew what was coming up next. And so I do think that there's not a lot of predictability. But the press also has to understand, when I watched so-called mainstream shows on Sunday morning, for example, that were national, the just outward contempt for Donald Trump was so obvious. It was so dripping out of people's mouths that they just couldn't stand him. They didn't want him to win. And it was like they were cheering for his demise electorally. And the average person has their radar up just a little bit. And we're not as dumb as what a lot of those people think we are out here in the Midwest. And so a lot of people saw through that. And I think that open contempt actually emboldened a lot of Donald Trump supporters.
I think that's right. Annette, how about to the example, though, that I gave, which is when he tweets or asserts things that for which there is little evidence, do Trump support... You know, what role does the media play in that, and do Trump supporters really care what the media is doing about that?
I think the media has taken a pretty big hit in the last couple of years, and I think a lot of that has to do with what I call the elephant in the room. We expect a free and open and aggressive press. We expect First Amendment rights to be respected at all levels. And we talked a little bit on the periphery of this issue about the political correctness that has invaded our country, about the restrictions of free speech that we see coming from some of the highest levels of our government, where people are suddenly saying, you run a nonprofit group, we demand to know your donors. We've seen this from the Obama administration. You run a nonprofit organization, we're going to not approve you because we don't like your mission. I think this has been what the average American looks at and say, excuse me, press, why are you covering this when there's a bigger issue over here, which is the restrictions of Americans' free speech that has gone completely uncovered. And so they look at that as a little bit of hypocrisy, that everything Donald Trump, every utterance, every tweet, every speech, everything has been, the level of scrutiny is probably unprecedented. And with some, there is some merit to checking out everything he says, especially like the voter fraud things, absolutely. But they expect it on both sides, and they don't see it on both sides. There were things that Mrs. Clinton said throughout the campaign, the basket of deplorables. That was a one-day story, and that was about it. Hey, as one of those deplorables, I kind of resented that and wondered why we don't talk about the disdain that Washington has. One-day story, you never heard about it again.
Carrie, what would you say to that?
I just think that this is a great opportunity for the press to take a look at why they were held in such disdain and why what they said really drove the Trump voters to vote.
Right.
And so it's a really good opportunity, I think, for the media to take a look and see, what is my role now that we have this president who is going to do things differently and maybe not include us at this level? So how can we, for the next 4 years, really be effective, and what will be a good role for us to play? Not that we always wanted to defend our First Amendment rights, but what's a better role to play to get the story out and to look at the balance of how we do things? So I think this is a great opportunity for all of us to kind of take a step back and say, well, how do we do this better? Because it really was so contentious and it didn't work very well. I think that the Twitter, you know, to have the president on Twitter is really interesting.
Interesting in a sense of risky or interesting?
It's very risky. Yeah. You know, I use Twitter a lot, but my Twitter is like, hi, I'm at the parade, at the Aiken Fish House Parade. I'm very careful on what goes
out. Are you tweeting
out
at 3 a.m. from here?
That would be no, because I'm watching the inside of my eyelids at 3 a.m., so I'm not tweeting. So I think we're all going to, as we go forward, we're all going to take a look, and it's going to be a really high learning curve for all of us.
Okay, here's the other question I was curious about, which is, as experienced political people, as you all are, I'm interested in what this 2016 political season told you about politics that you didn't already know. Annette?
Wow.
I think this is a good one for you, too, because of some of the stuff you were saying before the convention and the election. What have you learned?
I have learned that things are changing so rapidly in politics. You were talking about tweets. Tweets were not even an issue 8 years ago when President Obama was elected. I don't think Twitter was around until a year after he was elected. But in the meantime, there have been several other new apps, and it's rapidly evolving, and I think we will see that continue to evolve in the days ahead. And that's part of what the mainstream media has got to figure out, what is their role.
Right, but what did you learn?
Well, I learned that things are changing fast. And those that keep up with it, I think that was one of the things that Donald Trump did that none of the other 17 candidates did. He was the king of social media. He was the instant responder. He was the one who was always had an opinion, something to say. It kept him in the news. And he even talked about that after he won the nomination, that all the free media that he'd received as a result of his social media action was worth several billion dollars. I think television and traditional methods are going to change. We saw them play a less important role in this election. I think that key targeting demographics will play an ever-increasing role. So you're seeing a bigger role for targeted social media, targeted mail, all of those things that reach targeted voters, whether their issues are guns or religious conservatives or whatever it is. I think that's going to continue to play an increasing role.
Little fact check here. Twitter was created in 2006.
Oh, there you go. I'm the late adapter.
Predated.
I think I didn't join until 2009.
President Obama.
My bad.
Carrie, what did you learn about politics that you didn't already know and about who we are as voters?
Wow, that I didn't know. Well, I think I had some things that I thought I knew that were kind of I did my whole campaign differently this time, and I was kind of hoping, and I knew that with the Trump train coming down the track, that I had the opportunity to kind of maybe do that something differently and see if it would work for me, because it was a different election. And I think the old way of doing elections are gone.
So you learned that there's a new way to reach voters?
To reach voters, okay. And that the old methods really, people say, okay, you need to do this, 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 and that's not really true anymore. The social media has really come into play, how we reach people, how they do things differently, our cell phones, all of that is really, you know, when I was elected in 2002, we were the first class to have laptop computers in the Senate.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And when I was reelected in 12, I had got the same computer. So that's, you know.
It's a little flat at
some point. So we, you know, we really need to, all these groups that think, and I think that's the establishment Republicans that came and said, okay, we have always campaigned this way, and so this is how you must campaign. I will tell you, I didn't send out one mailer.
Wow.
And I door knocked, yes, but it's a lot different door knocking than what we did previously. And so the campaigns, if you want to reach your voters, you have to step up into the century, and we can't be the dinosaur of campaigns that we're seeing from the establishment.
Marty, what did you learn that you didn't know?
I think being different makes you stand out. I mean, Trump, obviously.
Ventura, you knew that.
Ventura, Wellstone, Bernie Sanders, as much as he didn't win the primary, he came darn close. He did well in Minnesota. I think being different, being genuine, the person with the most money doesn't always win. That is what Trump really proved, is that, you know what, all these other people
had the most money.
Well, he had personally did, but his campaign kind of was running on vapors, and just this organic group of people showing up to vote in these primaries. Was he winning a majority? No, he's winning a plurality. But as Senator Rood said, he beat 17 people. Even if he beat them by a few percent here and there, he caught lightning in a bottle each time until you got to the convention and he was the nominee. And so I think as the playbook was thrown out, but I would caution Republicans, this isn't a permanent realignment.
I was just thinking this that, and not, I was curious about that.
I mean, Hillary, the number of people who said I voted against Hillary Clinton or the Supreme Court, a lot of my neighbors said the Supreme Court is too important to just hand it over to Hillary. You know, that's not a mandate for a man or a party. That's like, we're afraid of Hillary. And it's kind of like the Democrats in the 70s won these major victories in 74 and 76 and had all these governors, legislators, President Carter, the Congress. And it was all wiped away with Ronald Reagan a few years later because they didn't have a permanent realignment. It was, we don't like Nixon. We don't like corruption. We're voting for something else. We have to be very understanding that this isn't a permanent realignment. But whatever change that we're going to make, if we really believe it in our soul, it needs to be done quickly, whether it's the legislature or the congressional level, because people get fickle and out you go.
Annette, I want to ask you about the alignment here in just a couple minutes. Do you think Marty is right?
I think he's spot on. I think this is one of the things that the Democrats learned very well with Bill Clinton, and they became a very centrist party concerned with middle class and Main Street America. And they lost their way. Under Barack Obama, they have become a very narrow party, and Hillary Clinton even more so.
Then again, he got reelected, I mean, to a second term, so.
Yeah, I would say that had more to do with the Republican nominees in the last two presidential terms and the general lack of excitement that they generated amongst rank-and-file Americans. I don't think they appealed beyond the base Republican vote versus Donald Trump, who reached into that independent voter that, as Marty said, doesn't vote every time and certainly doesn't vote Republican every time.
So that's the caution for the Republican Party.
This is not a realignment election. This was not a wave election. This was not a mandate that says we want a conservative America. This was an election that said, I want you to go and get things done and shake up Washington and, by golly, fix our problems. And as Marty said, voters are very fickle. You don't get that done, they'll toss you out. And rightfully so. And I think the state Senate and the state House also have that mandate, which is let's get things done. Quit going up there bickering, fighting, leaving the problems for someone else, kicking the can down the road, as they like to say. Mm-hmm. Let's get it done.
And get it done sooner rather than later.
That's right.
I would tell the legislators, as long as I have one here, you know, don't wait until the ninth hour to pass one budget. Pass a good, solid budget on April 30th and get it. We're all Republicans in the House and Senate now. Get it done early. If the governor vetoes it, you know, come back. Do another one, maybe moderate it ever so slightly. And do it three times, and by the time May 19th rolls around, we'll know who the obstructionist is. It'll be the governor.
That's a great lesson,
Marty. Don't just
Marty.
Do it at the end. Do three of them.
And we're
all on the same page. I think in 2011, we had the House and Senate at that time, but I don't know, you know, if Amy Koch and Kurt Zeller's, you know, had that clicking or not, but we have the opportunity now to click.
That's a great example of what happened in Washington under Bill Clinton. Republicans in the remember, we control both bodies of House and Senate, passed welfare reform three times before Bill Clinton signed it into law. And it was harder and harder every time to say, come on, people, vote for this again. This is the right thing to do. We're going to get Americans back to work instead of dependent upon government for generation after generation. And it's been transformational in the last 20 years. But we had to pass it three times and present it to the president.
And they had to moderate it a little bit on some things like child care credits.
Absolutely.
And on work requirements not being as strict as they originally were. So they did, the Democrats did win on moving it to the center ever so slightly. But at the end of the day, sometimes you got to do it two or three times to get it done.
Marty, Carrie, Annette, thank you for a lively and insightful roundtable. Good to have you. We'll see what happens next, right? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to have you here.